Switzerland Conquests. Chapter 4. Reformation of St. Gall. The Reformation of Bern was decisive for several cantons. The same wind that had blown from on high with so much power on the country of De Watteville and Haller threw down the idols in a great part of Switzerland. In many places the people were indignant at seeing the Reformation checked by the timid prudence of diplomatists. But when diplomacy was put to flight at Bern, the torrent so long restrained poured violently onwards. Vadian, burgomaster of St. Gall, who presided at the Bernese disputation, had scarcely returned home, when the citizens, with the authority of the magistrates, removed the images from the church of St. Magnus, carried to the mint a hand of the patron saint in silver, with other articles of plate, and distributed among the poor the money they received in exchange. Thus, like Mary, pouring their precious ointment on the head of Christ. The people of St. Gall, being curious to unveil the ancient mysteries, laid their hands on the abbey itself, on the shrines and crosses which had so long been presented to their adoration. But instead of saintly relics, they found, to their great surprise, nothing but some resin, a few pieces of money, several paltry wooden images, some old rags, a skull, a large tooth, and a snail's shell. Rome, instead of that noble fall which marks the ends of great characters, sunk in the midst of stupid superstitions, shameful frauds, and the ironical laughter of a whole nation. Such discoveries unfortunately excited the passions of the multitude. One evening some evil-disposed persons, wishing to alarm the poor nuns of St. Catherine, who had obstinately resisted the reform, surrounded the convent with loud cries. In vain did the nuns barricade the doors. The walls were soon scaled, and the good wine, meat, confectionaries, and all the far from ascetic delicacies of the cloister became the prey of these rude jesters. Another persecution awaited them. Dr. Schappeler having been appointed their catechist, they were recommended to lay aside their monastic dress and to attend his heretical sermons. "Clothed like all the world," said the sister Wibberath. Some of them embraced the reform, but 30 others preferred exile. On the February 5, 1528, a numerous synod framed the constitution of the Church of St. Gall. The struggle was more violent at Glarus. The seeds of the gospel truth, which Zwingli had scattered there, prospered but little. The men in power anxiously rejected every innovation, and the people loved better to leap and dance and work miracles, glass in hand, as an old chronicle says, than to busy themselves about the gospel. The Landsmind having pronounced, on the May 15, 1528, in favor of the Mass by a majority of 33 voices, the two parties were marked out with greater distinctness. The images were broken at Mat, Elm, and Bechwanden, and as each man remained aloof in his own house and village, there was no longer in the canton either council of state or tribunal of justice. At Schwanden, the minister Peter Rumelin, having invited the Roman Catholics to a disputation with him in the church, the latter, instead of discussing, marched in procession to the sound of drums round the place of worship in which the Reformed were assembled, and then rushing into the pastor's house, which was situated in the middle of the city, destroyed the stoves and the windows. The irritated Reformed took their revenge and broke the images. On the April 15, 1529, an agreement was concluded, by virtue of which every man was free to choose between the Mass and the sermon. At Wiesen, where Schwytz exercised sovereignty conjointly with Glarus, the deputies of the former canton threatened the people. Upon this the young men took the images out of the churches, carried them to an open place near the banks of the picturesque lake of Wallenstadt, above which soared the mountains of the Ammon and of the Seven Electors, and cried, "Look, this road that by the lake leads to Quarren to Rome, that to the south, to Glarus, this other, to the west, to Schwytz, and the fourth, by the Ammon, to St. Gall. Take which you please, but if you do not move off, you shall be burnt." After waiting a few moments, these young people flung the motionless images into the fire, and the Schwytz deputies, eyewitnesses of this execution, withdrew in consternation, and filled the whole canton with projects of vengeance that were but too soon realized. In the canton of Appenzell, where a conference had been opened, there suddenly appeared a band of Roman Catholics, armed with whips and clubs, and crying out, "Where are these preachers? We are resolved to put them out of the village." These strange doctors wounded the ministers and dispersed the assembly with their whips. Out of the eight parishes of the canton, Six embraced the reform, and Appenzell became finally divided into two little sections, the one Romanist and the other Reformed. In the Grisons, religious liberty was proclaimed. The parishes had the election of their pastors. Several castles were razed to the ground to render all return to arbitrary government impossible, and the affrighted bishop went and hid in the Tyrol his anger and his desire for vengeance. The Grisons, said Zwingli, advance daily. It is a nation that by its courage reminds us of the ancient Tuscans, and by its candor of the ancient Swiss. Schaffhausen, after having long halted between two opinions, at the summons of Zurich and of Bern removed the images from its churches without tumult or disorder. At the same time the Reformation invaded Thurgovia, the valley of the Rhine, and other bailiwicks subordinate to these cantons. In vain did the Roman Catholic cantons, that were in the majority, protest against it. When temporal affairs are concerned, replied Zurich and Bern, we will not oppose a plurality of votes, but the word of God cannot be subjected to the suffrages of men. All the districts that lie along the banks of the Thursday, of the Lake of Constance, and of the Upper Rhine, embrace the gospel. The inhabitants of Mamorin, near the place where the Rhine issues from the lake, flung their images into the water. But the statue of St. Blaise, after remaining some time upright, and contemplating the ungrateful spot whence it was banished, swam across the lake to Caterhorn, situated on the opposite shore, if we may believe the account of a monk named Lang. Even while running away, popery worked its miracles. Thus were the popular superstitions overthrown in Switzerland, and sometimes not without violence. Every great development in human affairs brings with it an energetic opposition to that which has existed. It necessarily contains an aggressive element, which ought to act freely, and by that means open the new path. In the times of the Reformation, the doctors attacked the Pope, and the people the images. The movement almost always exceeded a just moderation. In order that human nature may make one step in advance, its pioneers must take many. Every superfluous step should be condemned, and yet we must acknowledge their necessity. Let us not forget this in the history of the Reformation, and especially in that of Switzerland. Zurich was reformed. Bern had just become so, Basel still remained, before the great cities of the Confederation were gained over to the evangelical faith. The reformation of this learned city was the most important consequence resulting from that of the warlike Bern. For 6 years the gospel had been preached in Basel. The meek and pious Ecolampadius was always waiting for happier times. The darkness, said he, is about to retire before the rays of truth, but his expectation was vain. A triple aristocracy, the superior clergy, the nobles, and the university checked the free expansion of Christian convictions. It was the middle classes who were destined to effect the triumph of the Reformation in Basel. Unhappily, the popular wave invades nothing without tossing up some foul scum. It is true that the gospel had many friends in the councils, but being men of a middle party, they tacked backwards and forwards like Erasmus, instead of sailing straight to the port. They ordered the pure preaching of the Word of God, but stipulated at the same time that it should be without Lutheranism. The aged and pious Bishop Jüdenheim, who was living in retirement at Brentrut, tottered daily into the church, supported by two domestics, to celebrate Mass with a broken voice. Gundelsheim, an enemy of the Reformation, succeeded him ere long, and on the September 23rd, followed by many exiles and with a train of 40 horses, he made his triumphal entry into Basel, proposing to restore everything to its ancient footing. This made Ecolampadius write in alarm to Zwingli, "Our cause hangs upon a thread." But in the citizens the reform found a compensation for the disdain of the great, and for the terrors inspired by the new bishop. They organized repasts for 50 and 100 guests each. Ecolampadius and his colleagues took their seats at these tables with the people, where energetic acclamations and reiterated cheers greeted the work of the Reformation. In a short time even the council appeared to incline to the side of the gospel. 20 feast days were retrenched, and the priests were permitted to refuse celebrating the Mass. "It is all over with Rome," was now the cry. But Ecolampadius, shaking his head, replied, "I am afraid that, by wishing to sit on two stools, Basel will at last fall to the ground." This was at the period of his return from the discussion at Bern. He arrived in time to close the eyes of his pious mother, and then the reformer found himself alone, succumbing under the weight of public and domestic cares, for his house was like an inn for all fugitive Christians. "I shall marry a Monica," he had often said, or else I shall remain a bachelor. He thought he had now discovered the Christian sister of whom he was in search. This was Willibrandis, daughter of one of the Emperor Maximilian's knights, and widow of a master of arts named Keller, a woman already proved by many trials. He married her, saying, I look to the ordinances of God, and not to the scowling faces of men. This did not prevent the sly Erasmus from exclaiming, Luther's affair is called a tragedy, but I maintain it is a comedy, for each act of the drama ends in a wedding. This witticism has been often repeated. For a long time it was the fashion to account for the Reformation by the desire of the princes for the church property, and of the priests for marriage. This vulgar method is now stigmatized by the best Roman controversialists as a proof of a singularly narrow mind. The Reformation originated, add they, in a true and Christian, although unenlightened zeal. The return of Ecolampadius had still more important consequences for Ball than it had for himself. The discussion at Bern caused a great sensation there. Bern, the powerful Bern, is reforming, was passed from mouth to mouth. How then? Said the people one to another. The fierce bear has come out of his den. He is groping about for the rays of the sun. And Ball, the city of learning Ball, the adopted city of Erasmus and of Ecolampadius, remains in darkness. On Good Friday, April 10, 1528, without the knowledge of the council and Ecolampadius, five workmen of the spinner's company entered the church of St. Martin, which was that of the reformer, and where the mass was already abolished, and carried away all the idols. On Easter Monday, after the evening sermon, 34 citizens removed all the images from the church of the Augustines. This was going too far. Were they desirous, then, of drawing Ball and its councils from that just medium in which they had till this moment so wisely halted? The council met hastily on Tuesday morning, and sent the five men to prison, but on the intercession of the burghers, they were released, and the images suppressed in five other churches. These half-measures sufficed for a time. On a sudden the flame burst out anew with greater violence. Sermons were preached at St. Martin's and St. Leonard's against the abominations of the cathedral, and at the cathedral the reformers were called heretics, knaves, and profligates. The papists celebrated mass upon mass. The burgomaster Meyer, a friend of the reform, had with him the majority of the people. The burgomaster Meltinger, an intrepid leader of the partisans of Rome, prevailed in the councils. A collision became inevitable. The fatal hour approaches, says Ecolampadius. Terrible for the enemies of God. On Wednesday, the December 23rd, 2 days before Christmas, 300 citizens from all the companies, pious and worthy men, assembled in the hall of the gardener's company, and there drew up a petition to the Senate. During this time the friends of popery, who resided for the most part in Little Ball and the suburb of St. Paul, took up arms, and brandished their swords and lances against the reformed citizens at the very moment that the latter were bearing their petition to the council, and endeavored, although ineffectually, to bar their road. Meltinger haughtily refused to receive the petition, and charged the burghers, on the faith of their civic oath, to return to their homes. The burgomaster Meyer, however, took the address, and the Senate ordered it to be read. Honored, wise, and gracious lords, it ran. We, your dutiful fellow citizens of the companies, address you as well-beloved fathers, whom we are ready to obey at the cost of our goods and of our lives. Take God's glory to heart, restore peace to the city, and oblige all the Pope's preachers to discuss freely with the ministers. If the Mass be true, we desire to have it in our churches. But if it is an abomination before God, why, through love for the priests, should we draw down his terrible anger upon ourselves and upon our children? Thus spoke the citizens of Ball. There was nothing revolutionary either in their language or in their proceedings. They desired what was right with decision, but also with calmness. All might still proceed with order and decorum. But here begins a new period. The vessel of reform is about to enter the port, but not until it has passed through violent storms.